and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, former President Bill Clinton said yesterday that his wife Hillary lost her presidential bid only because the Russian government preferred Green Party candidate Jill Stein. Clinton claimed disingenuously that without Stein, Hillary would have won the states of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, and with them, the presidency. Next, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani today announced an unconditional week-long ceasefire with the Taliban to mark the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. This is the first time that a ceasefire has been called without any preconditions. Ghani specified, however, that it does not apply to other groups, including ISIS. Then, Democrats are taking a very hard line on the North Korea summit, requiring, quote, complete, verifiable, and irreversible dismantlement of North Korea's nuclear program, unquote, in order to remove the crippling U.S. economic sanctions. Meanwhile, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is visiting the White House today for meetings with President Trump. Abe reportedly is expressing his concerns over North Korea in advance of next week's summit there, and he's asking the president to convince the North Koreans to release Japanese citizens. And then the White House's top economic advisor said today that President Trump is not backing down from his hard line on trade, setting the stage for a showdown with top allies at the G7 summit in Canada this week. The meetings on Friday and Saturday will be the first time that allied leaders have had to confront Trump in person since he instituted steep tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from Canada, Mexico, and the European Union. And finally, Russian President Vladimir Putin is visiting Austria today as part of a policy to improve relations with the European Union. He's also working to improve economic and trade relations with Europe in the aftermath of tariffs imposed on steel and aluminum by President Trump. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. But first, we turn to politics. Former President Bill Clinton said yesterday that his wife Hillary lost her presidential bid only because the Russian government preferred Green Party candidate Jill Stein. Clinton claimed, disingenuously, that without Stein, Hillary would have won the states of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, and with them, the presidency. We're joined from Colombia by Ajamu Baraka. He's a national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace, a longtime human rights activist, political organizer and political activist, and the 2016 Green Party nominee for Vice President of the United States. Ajamu, welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Without laughing too hard, what do you make of this comment by Bill Clinton yesterday?
Yeah, I mean, Ajamu, up until Bill Clinton's interview with the New York Times the other day, I thought that Donald Trump was the preferred alternative for the Russians. But now we find out from Bill Clinton that you and Jill Stein were the preferred alternative for the Russians, and you're the reason that Hillary Clinton is not president right now.
Right. It's all on your shoulders.
I guess the investigations and all the inquiries have finally revealed the truth, that it was all about the Green Party and giving the people an alternative beyond the two parties. You know, John, Brian, that's really the objective of those comments. It is to delegitimize any kind of politics and any kind of participation in the electoral arena outside of the two main parties. So basically, if you believe in a expanded democracy, more choice, if you support a third party challenge, then you are effectively signing on to a conspiracy to undermine democracy in the U.S. It is absolutely incredible and incredible that this individual would even voice something like that outrageous.
You know, just as a practical matter, one of the things that I'm always astounded by, and you see this every time there's a serious third party candidate, is that the losing candidate always believes that every one of those third party votes would have gone to him or to her. And that's just never the case, because polls are conducted on these issues after the fact. Look back to the 2000 election. Al Gore blamed Ralph Nader. And then, in fact, Ralph Nader's voters said that they would have pretty well evenly split between Gore and Bush. And the same thing happened with Ross Perot in 1992. And the same thing happened, you know, this year with Gary Johnson and Jill Stein. I don't know how people like Bill Clinton make this leap in logic and just assume that their candidate would have won when the numbers aren't there to prove it.
Arrogance, The notion that those votes belong to the Democrat Party, and it's that kind of arrogance that caused them to organize and execute the kind of campaign that they in fact executed that ended up losing them that that position, a position that most people believe was theirs to in fact lose. So, no, this is incredible. That's why we don't, at least I don't, get into the conversation around the specific numbers in those three contested states. Because, you know, for me, anytime you have Democratic choice and people entrust you with their votes, that is the essence of Democratic participation. And so, you know, our objective is to expand democracy, not to be on the defensive and having to explain to people like Bill Clinton why there were people out there that had enough confidence in us to, in fact, give us their support.
You know, Jill Stein and Ajemu Baraka stood for peace, a different U.S. foreign policy, a foreign policy that was not addicted to militarism and war or colonialism or racism. And now you have, as Ajemu's pointing out, it's really all of the Russiagate attack, and it's led by the Democratic Party, but it's in a way a bipartisan affair. And you have the Republicans and the Democrats hauling Jill Stein before the Senate Intelligence Committee to account for herself and even demanding, which she refused to give, internal deliberations of an alternative party over to a committee that's dominated exclusively by the two ruling class parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. All of that is happening, but it's really an attack on independent left voices like Jill Stein and Ajemu Baraka. When I'm just, if you Google the terms, the phrase, Jill Stein impact on swing states, and that's what we're talking about, because that's what Clinton said, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. Here's what you come up with. Number one, Trump's victory margin smaller than Stein's vote in key swing states. Two, Jill Stein, Democratic spoiler or scapegoat. Three, how Gary Johnson and Jill Stein helped elect Donald Trump. Four, did Jill Stein cost Hillary Clinton the election? Did Jill Stein voters deliver Donald Trump the presidency? Last one, everybody hates Jill. Well, no, they don't.
No, ridiculous.
And as Ajemu was saying, a lot of people are sick and tired of the Democratic and Republican Party, so they don't vote. They don't come out. Or if they do come out, they vote for an independent candidate like Jill Stein and Ajemu Baraka, the Green Party candidates. And Jill Stein has actually done some studies that show that if, and I agree with Ajemu, it's not even necessary to defensively respond, but what she has done is she's tried to parse some of this, is that the people who voted for her, either one, would not have voted at all, or two, they would have split, you know, between the other candidates. So there's no empirical evidence that this is true. But now we have, Ajemu, a situation where the Russiagate becomes the vehicle. Back in 2000, it was just Ralph Nader is evil. If this had happened now, it would be Ralph Nader is a tool of the Russians. And now we have you guys are the tool of the Russians, or the Black Lives Matter movement is the tool of the Russians, or anybody who's doing anything progressive that undermines or challenges U.S. consensus positions is in some way or another a stooge of a hostile foreign power. Go ahead.
You know, what is really troubling, though, is that these comments don't seem to be just random. There seems to be a real effort to sort of preempt any kind of third party challenge. I think that the Democrats have decided that they're going to make sure that they can preempt any kind of challenge to their hegemony in particular states by going on the attack 2 years out. There was two articles in the Daily Beast last week or so, another article and another publication attacking me directly. There was this demonstration against me at the Left Forum this weekend. There seems to be something that's percolating out there to try to engage in character assassination to undermine any possible challenge coming from the Green Party. So this is another example, I think, of the kind of real concern that these two parties have around any kind of independent expression of democracy. And that's why it is vitally important for us, to those of us who believe in protecting the limited democratic space that does exist, to in fact defend democracy or defend this process and demand for the democratic process to, in fact, be expanded. So, you know, this is not haphazard. I think this is something that's a part of a contrived attack. Look, the other thing I want to say real quick was that this notion of the Green Party being part of some grand conspiracy from the Russians, I guess we didn't get the memo because we remember it was Jill Stein that decided to challenge the vote in those three states because of the alleged possibility of some kind of foreign tampering. So, you know, the Democrats can't get it together. Either she's a stooge for the Russians or, you know, she's something else. So, you know, this is another incredible and insulting attack against us and against democracy in general.
I want to add one thing to that, too, and that is the duopoly's constant efforts to keep the Greens and the Libertarians and anybody else out of the presidential debates. Time was relatively recently as 2000, when Jill Stein and Gary Johnson would have been on stage with Hillary Clinton and with Donald Trump, and the American people would have been able to hear what they had to say and what they stood for. But the two main parties have just, because they have a monopoly on the whole political process, have kept them out. And this can only be changed through the courts.
Yeah, and it won't be changed through the courts. It's just a complete monopoly on political power at this point. Go ahead, Ajamu. We have 1 minute left.
Well, yeah, I think that's a good point. Basically, we know that if we would have had a chance to stand shoulder to shoulder with those candidates, that even the outcome of this election would have been quite interesting.
Absolutely. I think if people got a chance, the masses of people got a chance in those debates to hear Jill Stein or Ajamu Baraka, millions of people would have agreed with their political program. Millions, tens of millions, actually. And as a consequence, the whole nature of politics in the United States would be changed. And John, just as for our audience, as we're going out, you know what? Hillary Clinton never visited Wisconsin. She lost.
Yeah, that's right.
She lost the primary to Bernie Sanders. It might have occurred to her that it wasn't a given that she would win, given the fact that she had just lost.
That's right.
I mean, and here's the scapegoating of Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka. It is as Ajamu just said, disgusting.
It is. It's awful. Well, we'll end it there. We were joined by Ajamu Baraka. He's the national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace and a longtime human rights activist, organizer, and political activist. And he was the 2016 Green Party nominee for Vice President of the United States. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Afghan President Ashraf Ghani today announced an unconditional week-long ceasefire with the Taliban to mark the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. This is the first time that a ceasefire has been called without any preconditions. Ghani specified, however, that it does not apply to other groups, including ISIS. We're joined from Cleveland, Ohio by Kathy Kelly. She's co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Kathy, it's good to have you back.
Well, thank you. I just literally came back from Afghanistan last night. I landed in Washington, D.C., and I'm taking a Greyhound bus back to Chicago, so I'm glad we caught each other.
Well, fantastic. The timing is perfect. Tell us what the mood is like in Afghanistan in light of this announcement.
Well, I'm sorry the announcement hadn't been made at the point when I left, but the mood about the men who are walking, Pashto men who had undertaken a 400-mile walk from Helmand province to Kabul. They should be arriving in Kabul any day now. There was a lot of, we'll wait and see what happens, but, you know, tentativeness, which has to be expected because people have endured so much war and privation. But there was also a sense that this was a good thing, that people should take into their own hands the desire to make peace, because there was so much disappointment in the government, and also recognition that there's not just the Taliban fighting in Afghanistan. There are numerous fighting groups and networks, and that Ashraf Ghani seemed not to have very much control even over his own military.
Yeah, it's been like that for a long
time,
actually.
When former State Department official Matthew Ho resigned because of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, he said the reason is that the U.S. military presence, or the NATO military presence in Afghanistan, was in fact the catalyst for the armed rebellion or rebellions. And he cited, I think he said there were more than 100 armed groups that were functioning, not simply the Taliban, which, you know, of course, people reading corporate-owned mainstream media
right,
here would not
know that.
Would not know that at all. I hope the audience here in Washington, D.C. and other American cities understand that part of it, Kathy?
Well, I think that actually people can understand quite well here what it means when there aren't jobs, when there aren't futures economically for people. They often will be far more vulnerable to entering into work with police groups or with security, so-called security, or the military in this country. Well, that has certainly happened in Afghanistan, but people who can't find a way to feed their families will sign up with these various networks that are training them how to use weapons. There are loads of weapons, many of them left over by the United States when we had our troop surge there. And gun runners get more weapons into the country. And so one of the main jobs in Afghanistan has to do with learning how to shoot a gun and operate various kinds of weaponry. So that's one thing that I think will make it very difficult to establish a lasting peace, because, of course, there will be questions of retaliation and revenge. There's been so much killing and suffering caused by the war so far, with the United States being the most sophisticated, the most well-armed, the most dangerous of all the warlords. But I think the other thing is that for there to be a lasting peace, there would have to be infusion of the means to create alternative jobs quickly and to sustain a long process of rehabilitating the Afghan agricultural infrastructure. And I believe the United States does bear major responsibility for that. And that's something it'll be very hard for people in the U.S. to understand. Why would the U.S. be required to pay reparations for the suffering caused when we've already spent enormous sums of money? But the enormous sums of money spent in Afghanistan by United States agencies were squandered. They were fuel for further corruption, and they created, in some ways, a way to get money to the Taliban, because the Taliban were using the demand for protection as a way to say, well, if you don't want us to shoot at your troops, then you're going to have to pay us not to do that. And that was a way to get money to the Taliban during the Obama administration's years.
Interesting. It reminds me also of what happened in Iraq with the so-called surge in 2007, whereby Bush put, you know, tens of thousands more U.S. troops into Iraq. But what the U.S. government was basically doing was paying resistance forces to stop shooting Americans. They actually put them on the salary. That was the awakening movement. I mean, something similar then. That's what you're suggesting.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's foolish for us to think that you can entrust to military groups or groups working alongside the military the means for humanitarian assistance. And it's also foolish to think that when you have huge numbers of military people in a country, you're not going to expand the military presence by generating many more armed groups and people thinking, well, the only way to make money is to get aligned with one or more of these groups and be able to have a weapon yourself.
You know, I'm interested, too, in the attitude of some of these groups. We just don't hear about them anymore in the U.S. media. The Haqqani Network, for example, or any of the groups that were up north. I'm interested to know their relationship with Ashraf Ghani's government. Is it different now than what it was like under Karzai? And I wonder how they're reacting to the notion of a ceasefire and perhaps the notion of a more lasting peace.
You know, the warlords whose names you would recognize from the past, Dostum, Sayyaf, people whose strength was so great within Afghanistan or operating perhaps out of Pakistan that Ashraf Ghani felt that he couldn't continue unless he integrated them into his own governance, has certainly been playing out. But also now we find that the sons of some of those major warlords are also becoming, declaring their intent to continue their father's ways. And so this is very, very bad news because it will I think, infect yet another generation of Afghans with the desire to try to gain control over territory, to gain land, to gain power. And I think ordinary Afghans feel a bit paralyzed by this. They've got, you know, the strength of the United States military might and weapons that are, you know, fabulously sophisticated, almost all like in a science fiction sort of way with in terms of the aerial attacks against people. And what can they do? You know, they don't have jobs. They can't feed their families. The education system is desperately deteriorated. And so the ability in that kind of chaos and misery for armed groups to come to the fore and persist is very, very strong.
We're talking with Kathy Kelly. She's just back from Afghanistan. We're talking about the unilateral announcement by the Afghan government led by Ashraf Ghani to have a week-long ceasefire with the Taliban. I'm looking at British media outlets and their take on it, Kathy. The NATO-led coalition said it would abide by the ceasefire. That's the U.S., of course. A spokesman for the Taliban said the Taliban senior leaders are in a meeting to decide upon Ghani's offer of a ceasefire, and we will update shortly. That's a quote. Anyway, is it you're painting a bleak and probably very realistic picture that war isn't simply the absence of peace; it's also the absence of so much else that's necessary to sustain life in Afghanistan. And war actually becomes a tool or a platform, a means by which people actually can eke out some sort of existence. With that in mind, do you have any feeling that there could be, that we could be sort of at a fork in the road?
Gosh, you know, I don't want to be overly pessimistic, but I think in terms of realism, we should also take into consideration that right now, 21 provinces in Afghanistan are stricken with drought. And that means, you know, the livestock die, the plants aren't growing, people are more desperate, they flock to the cities. The cities can't take the soaring populations in terms of any kind of, you know, means to manage sewage and sanitation and water distribution. And so we're also seeing some of the water wars that could be predicted because of climate change, but also because of neglect of ways to cope with climate change. And Afghanistan is one of the countries that's had the least carbon footprint in terms of ordinary Afghans consumption of non-renewable energies, but it's one of the countries that's going to be very, very hard hit by climate change. And so, you know, you saw the fighting up in Farah province, and there's, you know, sure enough, there's a hydroelectric dam project that sort of rerouted some water supplies, and it could be that that was part of the reason that the Taliban got involved in a fight up in that area. But we also see that the Taliban have followed a strategy of surrounding cities, and then every now and then, like in Farah or in Kunduz, going in and taking over just to sort of show we could do this, and then they withdraw. But certainly, Ashraf Ghani is on the defensive right now, not launching offensives, but trying to defend a very strong Taliban group, which is in, the Taliban certainly are in a position for negotiating, which would be considered a position of strength.
That's the voice of Kathy Kelly. She's the co-coordinator for Voices for Creative Nonviolence. John, what the American people need to hear and who they need to hear is Kathy Kelly.
Absolutely.
Because she's just back from Afghanistan. She's been there over and over again. She actually knows what's going on. And the American people actually know nothing about what's going on, even though this is the longest war.
Yeah, what we're fed by the wire services. That's all we get here. We don't get these firsthand views like Kathy just gave us. I wish we could go for another half hour, but we're out of time. We were joined from Cleveland, Ohio by Kathy Kelly. Kathy's the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Democrats are taking a very hard line on the North Korea summit, requiring, quote, complete, verifiable, and irreversible dismantlement of North Korea's nuclear program, unquote, in order to remove the crippling U.S. economic sanctions. Meanwhile, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is visiting the White House today for meetings with President Trump. Abe reportedly is expressing his concerns over North Korea in advance of next week's summit there, and he's asking the president to convince the North Koreans to release Japanese citizens that it holds. We're joined from Norfolk, Connecticut by Patrick Lawrence. He's the author of Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century, and he's a columnist at The Nation. You can support his work at www.patreon.com/theflautist. Patrick, welcome back.
Thank you very much, John. Good to be here.
So, Patrick, here we are on the eve, practically, of this summit. The president met with Shinzo Abe today. They held a joint news conference this afternoon. Do you think this is actually going somewhere?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it can. Let's talk potential. It can go extremely exciting places. This is a moment, 30 years of covering Asia and Korea. It's never been this dynamic in my experience. So, yeah, it can. Whether it will or not, you know, it's a hard read. It's too much in the potential category now, and there's too much that can go wrong. What I'm referring to here are not North Korean problems, and certainly not South Korean. We're talking about what goes on in Washington.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about that, because, of course, Donald Trump accepted the invitation of the North Koreans delivered by a South Korean envoy. He accepted it right away. Maybe some of his aides didn't even know about it, but he said, yes, I'm ready to meet with Kim Jong-un. And then the momentum accelerated. Then you had John Bolton going on national TV saying, well, we envision the Libya model for North Korea, which, of course, from the North Korean point of view, means regime change, the destruction of our government, the killing of our head of state. And then you had Mike Pence reiterating that, saying, well, John Bolton isn't threatening. That's just a fact of what will happen. Or Donald Trump had reiterated something like it. So then the North Koreans basically said, okay, maybe we won't come to the summit. And then Donald Trump canceled the summit. And then the North Koreans got back to Donald Trump and said, look, if you change your mind, we're still ready to talk. Then you had the Democratic Party, Patrick, Chuck Schumer and that gang sounding almost exactly like John Bolton. In other words, establishing preconditions and using the language that the North Koreans will consider to be insulting and unacceptable. And then just yesterday, Rudolph Giuliani, Trump's lawyer, saying, oh, yeah, Kim Jong-un got down on his hands and knees in order to get Donald Trump to say yes to the summit again after he canceled it. Again, something from the point of view of the North Koreans. I mean, you can't get more provocative. Anyway, many different voices, but Trump's voice seems to be going against the tide almost here in Washington.
Thanks for the opportunity to address this. The common position is shared on this program is that Trump is an unpredictable improviser. You never know what he's going to say on Wednesday, you know, or Thursday or Friday, right? I'm not with that, respectfully. I think he has been very constant about this. His motivations, yeah, sure, you know, he likes the limelight and all that. What Paul doesn't, maybe he does more than most, but that doesn't matter. He wants this. He's been very consistent. In cases such as Bolton and the Libya model remark, visibly, you know, it broke into the public sphere then, visibly out to disrupt this. What we need to bear in mind is, we're looking at an iceberg here. It is Washington is very opaque as to what's going on in the administration, Pentagon, State, the intelligence agencies. We don't really know, and that's why I insist with your listeners that we have to stay with a very big could be, right? I'll take a could be at this point,
Patrick. And for our audience, by the way, John, I'm on my way to Singapore this weekend. We're going to be covering, starting Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday at least, we'll be covering the summit from Singapore. Yep. We'll be bringing you interviews and coverage from there. And others in the Loud and Clear team will be here in our D.C. studio. One of the things that was noteworthy about this meeting with Shinzo Abe and Trump today is that they had a press conference afterwards. And the press, the first question that was asked of Trump is, will you sign a peace agreement? Will you normalize relations with North Korea? And Trump said these words. He said, I could see that happening at the summit, a peace agreement. He said, but that would just be the beginning. This will be the beginning. The hard part might come later. Will you normalize relations with North Korea? Yes, I could see that happening. And then finally, one of the reporters says, well, are you still using the term maximum pressure, meaning this full draconian economic sanctions? And he said, I'm not using the language of maximum pressure because that wouldn't be very nice to talk like that right before the negotiations at the summit. But yes, we have very heavy sanctions on North Korea. They're being retained. And he said, I have 300 other massive sanctions, in his words, that he's ready to place on North Korea, but he's held off on them because he thinks something really great could happen out of the summit.
Let me add something, too. We're recording this just a few minutes before 3 o'clock, and he just said that if the summit goes well, he intends to invite Kim Jong-un to visit the United States.
All right. Well, those are big developments. Go ahead, Patrick.
Yeah, a couple of remarks here. One, Trump has definitely, explicitly accepted the South Korean proposal, the original South Korean proposal, using the word process. This has to be a process. He appears to be setting aside the hawkish argument that everything has to happen all at once and everything has to happen on the North side before the United States will even begin to think about lifting sanctions. Trump seems to be putting that aside and accepting that it's a process. As to signing the document, well, number one, he hasn't signed anything yet. It's easy enough to say that. Number two, even if he does sign a document, it's in some measure gestural, right? It's a piece of paper. However, final point, it's a rather important piece of paper if the United States and North Korea can formally declare the end of hostilities that have been running 60 odd years. Well, that's a very big development, even if it is, and I agree on this point, the very, very front end of a long process. There's some substance to a declaration that hostilities are formally over. But the real grist of it is yet to come.
I want to ask you, Patrick, your opinion on something. Again, John Kiriakou just told us, again, we're recording this right around 3 o'clock, right before 3 p.m. Eastern time, that Donald Trump says he's actually willing to have Kim Jong-un come to the White House to meet him in Washington. There's been some speculation that this could lead to a reorientation of regional and even global politics. And I, of course, this is completely and purely speculative, and I don't necessarily put much in it, but there are some people who have argued within the Western, at least the Western media, that what Trump would like to do is to form a U.S., North Korean, South Korean relationship at the expense of North Korea's traditional relationship with China. I think that's remote and probably unlikely, because you're an Asia expert, I'd like to get your opinion on it.
There's not an either-or to that. The United States is never going to crowd China out of Northeast Asia. That's a pipe dream, right? American policy people tend to think in these categoric terms as if nations are sort of chess pieces.
Right.
Worry not about that, right? China shares a border of some hundreds of miles with North Korea.
900 miles, a big border.
900, good, okay. The thought that that would be like suggesting Russia is going to crowd out the American relationship with Mexico or Canada. It's not even remotely realistic. The interest it bears lies in how, I'm afraid to say it, but how detached from Asian realities Washington appears to be.
Yeah, I agree with you. In the pundit class in America, which is spinning out all of these theories and promoting them, and they're getting picked up a little bit, actually detach from Asian reality or just reality in general. I think Patrick Lawrence is right.
Yeah, I agree. We're going to have to end it there, though. We were joined from Norfolk, Connecticut by Patrick Lawrence. He's the author of Time No Longer, Americans After the American Century. And he's a columnist at The Nation. You can support his work at www.patreon.com/theflautist. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The White House's top economic advisor said today that President Trump is not backing down from his hard line on trade, setting the stage for a showdown with top allies at the G7 summit in Canada this week. The meetings on Friday and Saturday will be the first time that allied leaders have had to confront Trump in person since he instituted steep tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from Canada, Mexico, and the European Union. We're joined from Quebec City by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Walter, good to talk to you.
Good to be here.
So, Walter, there's a lot of talk today in Washington about Donald Trump not wanting to go to Charlevoix to go to the G7 summit because he doesn't want these other allied leaders to beat up on him over trade. What are people saying there? People you're talking to, what are they saying about trade and about these tariffs and Trump's arrival in Canada?
I think there's a very serious chance that he'll be embarrassed in a major way at the G7. And I think that's why there are these reports circulating that, you know, Trump is saying, well, why don't I just skip it? Why are we going here? Why don't I just prepare for the Singapore summit with Kim? Because, you know, he's picked a fight with some of, you know, both the most important economies in the world and those that are traditionally allies or junior partners, however you want to characterize it, to the United States. So it doesn't make a whole lot of strategic sense. And, you know, the people who are having these, or the countries that are having these tariffs imposed on them, are pointing that out in a very, a relatively sharp way. I mean, there's a debate going on, I think, on both sides where, you know, in the United States, there are those like Treasury Secretary Mnuchin who are not really for this and those who are, you know, very much in favor of protectionist measures. Just like that in the other G7 countries that are on the receiving end of the tariffs, I think there's a debate going on between, you know, conciliation, making concessions to Donald Trump and those who want to, you know, stand up to him, basically. But here, you know, I think a lot of people on the streets are going to be protesting for very different reasons because they oppose the model of globalization that the G7 represents, which they say favors the very, very wealthy, these massive transnational corporations at the expense of the people and the environment as well.
Walter Smolarek is our guest. We're talking to Walter from Quebec. From Quebec City. Walter, the Wall Street Journal, I'm looking at it, front page, top of the fold, U.S. is Trump's focus at G7. Tariffs on allies as part of aggressive trade agenda, so discord ahead of the gathering. And when you get to the third paragraph down, still front page, so prominently placed by the Wall Street Journal, here it is. For decades, the G7 summit has been a venue for the richest countries to coordinate policies around trade and shared values, and the U.S. was the group's undisputed leader. Now many observers believe that the Trump administration seems less interested in maintaining the post-World War II trading system and more concerned about domestic priorities. What's your comment?
I think that's very interesting. The G7 really was sort of this instrument of Western hegemony, I think. I mean, that was sort of the original idea behind it, that you know, it would be a forum for the most powerful capitalist countries in the world, which had as their undisputed leader the United States, would gather, they'd discuss, they'd debate, but it'd be a primarily friendly gathering where they would sort of work out the kinks in the world order that they were dominant in. And, you know, in regards to that quote about the post-World War II order, I mean, in terms of the economic post-World War II order, there were several important economic institutions, pillars of the New World Order set up at the Bretton Woods Conference in New Hampshire in, I believe, 1944. One is the International Monetary Fund. The other is the World Bank. And at the Bretton Woods Conference, there was an idea floated for what they called the International Trade Organization that never really got out off the ground. But, you know, decades later, we know it now as the World Trade Organization. And the G7 is sort of an auxiliary to that, maybe sort of a high-level summit where the actual heads of states could work out some of the issues that these sort of more regular institutions would not be able to work out themselves at a lower level. So I think that it is true to a great degree that the Trump presidency is breaking with a lot of the pillars of this post-World War II order. I mean, is it going to be a permanent lasting break? I mean, I don't see something quite that dramatic happening at the summit here, but it could be one more step down the road towards really the reorganization of world politics.
Walter, these G7 summits happen annually. Sometimes when there's, you know, a war in the offing or something important, they happen a little bit more frequently than that. The tariff issue is relatively new. So certainly there are other important topics that are going to come up in this summit. What might they be?
Well, there are a number of world flashpoints. I mean, Donald Trump was complaining that, you know, he's not going to have enough time, or, you know, this would distract from him preparing for the summit with Kim. And I think the crisis in Korea and the negotiations for peace in Korea will also be a topic of discussion. You know, Abe is meeting with Trump just before he goes to the G7 summit. So I think that there's lots of preparations underway there. I think the environment is going to be a major issue, certainly among the people organizing counter activities, demonstrations, protests. The environment is at the top of the list of things that they're concerned about, because they think that the G7 model of globalization, you know, what we could call neoliberal globalization, is fundamentally destructive to the planet. You know, the Canadian government recently effectively bailed out the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which is operated by the corporation Kinder Morgan, which will, you know, greatly increase fossil fuel production and therefore, you know, the burning of fossil fuels, which contributes to climate change. So I think the environment should also be added to the list of, you know, concerns that people generally have. How much it'll feature in the actual talks between the leaders, you know, remains to be seen. But I think that's something that people are really talking about a lot here in Quebec.
I'm glad there are going to be big protests. The G7, the group of seven, this annual summit, I think it should be dissolved. It should be abolished. It's just an imperial hangover from the 19th century. I mean, look who's the members of the G7 and who's not a member of the G7. France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Now, Canada is thrown in there because, of course, Canada is a principal U.S. ally and sort of has to be there. But France, Germany, Italy, Japan, United Kingdom, United States, those are the countries that were the main colonial powers of the 19th century and the 20th century. China's not there. I mean, why is there a meeting of these great industrialized leadership countries where you have so many other countries, particularly absent are, let's say, Africa, the Middle East, Latin America, and all of Asia, with the exception of Japan, which was the colonial overlord of the rest of Asia until 1945. It's just an imperial anachronism.
I agree with you. And, you know, if we think about, like, in terms of the world's population, who's represented there, I mean, as you laid out, there's these vast regions that aren't represented. And of course, that represents the overwhelming majority of the world's people. What it does represent is, you know, probably the majority or close to the majority of the world's wealth. And that's what this is really about. It's about the rich and powerful getting together to talk about how they can maintain their wealth and their power. You know, the colonial system, right, even though we don't really have a world system now, with some exceptions. Puerto Rico is definitely an exception, where, you know, the big powers, like, directly have possession over the weaker countries of the world or the oppressed countries of the world. But we do have a system where, through economic means, through political means, through both overt and covert military pressure, The countries of the G7, you know, the former colonial masters of the whole world, are still able to exercise effective control over large swaths of the world. And so, yeah, people are completely outraged at this fundamentally unfair, unequal, and undemocratic world system.
Walter, we always expect protests at these kinds of events. And indeed, over the last decade, we've seen a lot of violent ones. Are there any protests in the offing?
Yeah, so tonight there's going to be the first major demonstration. There have been several already, but they've been, you know, quite small about environmental concerns or sort of more street theater activities, which, you know, of course, are effective in their own way. But, you know, in terms of the big protest, that starts tonight at 6 o'clock. People will be gathering at Parc du Braves in Quebec City. You know, we should note that even though the summit is not happening in Quebec City itself, it's happening at a fancy resort just a little bit outside the city. The demonstrations will take place in the city to facilitate maximum participation and to avoid the really extreme, ridiculous security, quote-unquote security measures taken near the summit itself, which would be, you know, preclude any type of serious mass gathering. So that's going to happen tonight. You know, the local media, I was just watching a little bit of that last night. And, you know, as generally happens with these summits, there's an extreme amount of violence baiting that goes on in the media where they, you know, really try to get everybody, you know, in a state of panic and fear so that they don't themselves join the demonstrations. But that being said, you know, there's a massive police mobilization. The police are known for provoking things at these types of activities. So we'll have to see what happens tonight. There'll also be, you know, significant actions taking place throughout the day on Friday and another major mass march on Saturday. So I think that, you know, while the elites are meeting at their resort, hammering out the big issues that affect, you know, the overwhelming majority of the people will be present, although just not in the summit, outside the summit, protesting the summit.
Walter Smolarek, 1 minute left. You're going to be at a protest in a few hours. What's going on? What's it going to be? Is it going to be one of the big ones?
Yeah, it will be one of the big ones. It'll be one of the three major mass marches that are going on. You know, we saw a list circulated a little bit earlier today and last night of all the organizations that were endorsing. It's a pretty impressive array of groupings, you know, dozens and dozens. I believe it's over 50 now. You know, their concerns range from, you know, like I was saying earlier, environmental concerns. That's, you know, a major one, environmental groups, anti-poverty organizations, people who or groups that are on the political left, whether that be anarchists or socialists, a great number of labor organizers and activists will be there, I believe, as is common with these G7 summits. Canada has, you know, a strong labor movement, unlike in the United States, where there's no labor party. There is effectively a labor party in Canada called the New Democratic Party. And we'll see if any of their activists make an appearance. But, you know, I think that the police will be out in force as well. And we'll have to see how they react to everything, if they respect people's civil liberties, their right to free speech, their right to assembly and demonstration.
We will see. We were joined from Quebec City, Canada, by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. Russian President Vladimir Putin is visiting Austria today as part of a policy to improve relations with the European Union. He's also working to improve economic and trade relations with Europe in the aftermath of tariffs imposed on steel and aluminum by President Trump. We're joined from London by legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian George Galloway to talk about this. George Galloway, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Always a pleasure, guys.
Thank you for joining. George, Putin is basically trying, as we said in our introduction, mending or improving relations with Russia. And he's kind of telling Russia, I mean, kind of telling the European Union, I told you so, by going along with the United States on restrictive sanctions or tariffs against Russia. Now it's all coming back to haunt them. What's your take?
You know, this comes at a time when there is a widening fissure between the countries of Western Europe, even Britain, which is traditionally, of course, the closest to Washington, all the European powers. This fissure has been caused first by the personality and repulsiveness of much of the conduct and language of the United States president, and now by the policies of the U.S. president, particularly the Iran nuclear deal, in which all the European powers are ranged against Donald Trump, and therefore with Russia, on the need to maintain this deal. But that's not the only issue. On the scrapping and now refixing of the summit meeting with North Korea, the way in which Giuliani, for example, insulted the Koreans all over again this very day by saying that they had begged on their hands and knees for a summit with the United States, which of course will go down like a lead balloon in Pyongyang and indeed throughout Asia. A very insulting metaphor, a very insulting set of optics that conjures up. But thirdly, on the issue of tariffs against European business, as well as business from China and elsewhere in the world, even Canada and Mexico, this has, if you like, made a critical mass, has developed a critical mass of unhappiness in Europe against U.S. policy. So President Putin has very cleverly put himself now into this mix and quite correctly saying, you were led by the nose or kicked up the backside into increasingly belligerent postures and relations with Russia by the man who's now kicking you up the backside and is now seeking to lead you by the nose. And I think Putin's words will fall on welcoming ears in European public opinion, but unusually, even in the chancelleries of Europe, the governments of Europe, and even the EU.
George Galloway is our guest. George is the legendary anti-war leader, spokesperson, activist, also former British parliamentarian. George, I totally agree with you on that. And I think it's also interesting. I'm just looking at Putin's actual words that he spoke to the press. And there's another interesting element of this. And I'm going to read those words and then ask you to comment. Here's Putin. He says, the introduction, for example, of restrictive tariffs on steel, on aluminum, not only for Europe, but also for Canada and Mexico. In essence, these are also sanctions. They are related to the pragmatic national interests of the United States. And here's the interesting part. When, in 2007, I spoke in Munich, a speech that is frequently quoted nowadays, I spoke about the fact that the United States is widening the jurisdiction of its laws beyond its national borders, and this is unacceptable. And that's exactly what's happening now, also to our Europeans and other partners. Why is this happening? No one wanted to listen, and no one did anything to stop this from developing. So we have here a Donald Trump being Trump and certainly aggravating, accelerating a hostile position, not only against adversaries, but so-called allies alike. But Putin is also demarcating this trend as something that's gone on for a while back in 2007. Of course, that was during the George W. Bush reign.
And actually, it went back even farther. It went back to Ronald Reagan in 1986 when these extraterritorial, I would call them extrajudicial laws first went into effect.
Yep. George Galloway, go ahead.
Absolutely. And it is an important point that this long predates Donald Trump. He just expresses it in a particularly vulgar, asinine way. Don't forget, it was that nice President Barack Obama who was bugging the telephone of Chancellor Merkel of Germany, one of the United States' closest allies. It was George W. Bush who was bugging all the governments, including the British, of the Security Council of the United Nations in the run-up to the Iraq War. It was earlier presidents who insisted upon their right to sanction foreign companies who were doing business with Cuba, absolutely legally according to their own country's laws, but illegally according to the United States laws. Now, for me, President Trump and the U.S. government are entitled to govern their own country, even if they make laws that I don't like. But they're not entitled to govern my country. They're not entitled to govern the companies that are based in this country and other European countries, and not entitled to push them around, sanction them, fine them, subject them to extraterritorial economic sanctions. Well, Putin is right. That's what these things are. Whether they're legal in America, they're illegal internationally. But they are being done, and they've been done by a long line of U.S. presidents. However, this may be the straw that broke the camel's back, because that straw has been placed on the camel's back by someone who almost all Europeans are predisposed to disliking, distrusting, and holding as a figure of, well, a mixture of fear and fun. And so we have, if you like, a perfect storm now. And this fissure that I speak of is widening by the day. That's why Putin's intervention in Austria today is pushing an open door.
Putin spoke again. This is the annual, I think, 4-hour, 20-minute long call-in where people could just ask him about anything. Let's just move for a second, George. By the way, before we move, in Quebec at the G7, the other six members of the G7 are mainly talking against the United States under Donald Trump right now rather than working as a united front. But real quick, George, he was asked about the poisoning of Sergei Skripal and his daughter, a former British intelligence agent who had been in prison in Russia, released after 4 years, living for years in Britain, and then poisoned. Putin said, if, as Britain insists, a military chemical agent was used against these people, they would have died within seconds or minutes on the spot. Thank God this did not happen. Clearly, we are dealing with something other than a military agent. What's it like in the UK? The Skripal issue, the poisoning or whatever happened to them, was such a big deal. It led to a huge acceleration of anti-Russia exchanges or expulsions with the UK and with here in America. Do people talk about it now?
Well, it's become like the mystery of the Marie Celeste, the ghost ship that was found sailing, perhaps mythically, with no one having any idea of what happened on board, except it has much more serious international ramifications. The British government and, in total, the entire British media have literally stopped talking about it, any discussion of it, any development in it. And that can only be because the official British government narrative announced in such haste is now so defunct, so bankrupt of factual, evidential basis, that it's best just to gloss over it now and pretend that it never happened. Except, of course, sanctions on the back of it happened. All European governments were led into taking sanctions against Moscow on the basis of the words, just the words, of the British government, the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister in particular. It's a spectacular own goal. It's the mother of all own goals. And one day, I believe we will find out what happened. Some police officer currently in service will leave the service and will start to blow whistles about how the evidence simply didn't match up to the British government's rhetoric in this affair.
Yeah, George Galloway is our guest. The last thing, Putin also said, quote, it's a joke, close quote, to suggest that the Kremlin may have interfered in the 2016 presidential election in favor of Donald Trump. Here in America, it's now a religious matter. It's an article of faith that, in fact, Donald Trump's the president of the United States because of the Russians, although Bill Clinton said it's because of Jill Stein 2 days ago. Anyway, what's the attitude in Britain? 30 seconds left.
Well, the perfidy of Russia knows no bounds, according to the British state and its echo chamber in the media. They fixed the U.S. election. They fixed the Brexit referendum. They conjured up the Catalan revolt for independence for Catalonia. Yet the man, this Mephistophelian genius who did all that, was the same man who was stupid enough to try and assassinate two people in broad daylight in Britain with a military-grade chemical agent. You really couldn't make this up.
Yeah, you can't make it up. Anyway, we've been joined from London by legendary anti-war activist, organizer, spokesperson, and former British parliamentarian George Galloway.
You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time.
Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.